Mr. Hancock, as I requested. He did not like the show. What was I to do? Set things right. If I had thought that nothing could upset his ease, I'd have put him in the charge of our silly Kitty. I chose you because I trusted that whatever went awry, you would know how to bring things to his satisfaction. But I... No gentleman should leave this house disappointed, says Mrs. Chapel. You know that. But Mr. Hancock was sorely disappointed. I directed him to you the next day that you might put it right. And mark me, he was willing to go to you. That's half your job done for you. Why, you sent him away again.
I never did.
No?
Angelica searches her memory, a blur of wine and bedsheets and sweat.
I never so much as saw him, she says firmly. Never heard him. Had no notion he had called.
Eliza Frost was under the strictest instructions to let him in.
You spoke to her?
Simeon did.
And the blame is on them. I knew nothing of it.
Now is the moment to retreat graciously from the argument. A misunderstanding, one or the other should say. A misfortune. It could happen to anybody. But the words stick in both their throats. Angelica cocks her head in invitation of an apology. Mrs. Chapel looks in the other direction.
You ought to run a tighter ship, she snaps. 'Tis down to you to make sure these confusions do not occur.
Angelica's judgment is swayed by her wounded pride.
And you, madam?
I do not need you the way you need me, says Mrs. Chapel,
and although her tone is measured, it demands to be heeded.
I have been celebrated in this world since before you were born, since before even your mother was born, I don't doubt. I have standing. Your reputation rests only on what I have sent your way. You would do well to please me.
But Angelica is not heedful.
You may believe that if you wish, she says. But when I first returned to London, you and I were in accord that I was a valuable asset to you. And now that I am all about the town again, I'd reckon my value has only increased. Why, I could do as well as Belle Fortescue if I chose, so you had better not keep me down by assigning blame where there is none.
Will she relate this conversation to Georgie? She has not yet decided. It may indeed be indelicate to speak of such matters around him. She would not wish to seem a haggling street wench. No, more graceful to say nothing of it, and let him see the new respect with which her old board must treat her.
You struck the deal,
she finishes with relish.
You hired the mermaid from the gentleman, and he took it away again. That is not my lookout.
Mrs. Chapel claps her hands, less in real mirth than in the knowledge that it will goad her erstwhile protégé.
Oh, you wish to equal Mrs. Fortescue, do you? You might start by emulating her humility. For you know, dear, ambition comes to naught without it.
Angelica stamps her foot like a girl of 13. Mrs. Chapel's company arrests her in a certain daughterish petulance, and even in the face of such advice, she adopts the mantle of wounded party and the generation's old cry,
"Always favoured her!"
She flounces from her seat and succeeds in screwing out a few tears as she continues.
"How I strive to please you! And it's never enough, Mother Chapel, never!"
"None of that,"
says the abbess, who over her career has raised hundreds of girls.
"She may rail against it, but Belle Fortescue owes her current fortune in no small part to having always acquiesced to me."
"No, that is not so. You built her up so far, but then she went her own way. It don't signify now whether she is with you or against you."
Angelica does not have the words, but she both covets and resents what Belle has got, which is to take her own space in the world, to have come by some alignment of charms, to be celebrated for her own self.
"But you are not Belle," says Mrs. Chapel. "You are Angelica Neal. I have served you right so far, have I not?
Angelica draws herself to her full height.
I think I do very well on my own, as I told you I would. Oh, I, and I have met a wonderful kind man who will take care of me.
She crosses her fingers in the folds of her skirt.
You forget, Mrs. Chapel, that I will never be a mercenary, and I will do no business of yours that don't suit me.
Mrs. Chapel has heard speeches of this sort before, and is robust enough to pay it no particular heed.
Go then, she says, and make your own way. My door is always open to you, but, dear girl, we are all mercenaries. There's no escaping it.
Not I.
Indeed you. You have need to be the most mercenary of us all. Every kindness has its price, Mrs. Neal, and one so precariously set up as you would do well to know your own means.
There is nothing precarious about me, returns Angelica. You mean only to unsettle me.
So hold fast, dear girl. Hold fast.
Chapter 2. And thus it is that Mr. Hancock comes to sell his mermaid. It has been returned to his office by Simeon's own hand, and sits on the sideboard beneath its glass dome, waiting for him to bear it home once more to Deptford. He is damping down the coals when he hears a rapping on the front door that carries all the way through the building to his private office, as if somebody has taken a brass-headed cane to it. He's picked up his coat to leave, but hesitates at the sound of strange voices ushered into the outer office.
"Mr. Hancock," a man says, "the mermaid man. Where can he be found?"
He's expecting no visitor. He puts down his overcoat and opens his door.
"Why, I'm here," he says.
In the plain outer office, there is a party of four of the most splendid men. They are not dressed extravagantly, but the quality is evident. Their greatcoats are of a deep, rich indigo. Their cravats, the snowiest and gauziest white. Their wigs, pristine, uncrushed, unstained. And each wears a badge of a jewelled coronet on his arm, flanked with rampant gold-thread creatures.
"Gentlemen,"
he says, although his mind is all a fumble,
"what can I do for you?"
He is thinking, foolishly,
"Are they sent by Mrs. Neal? Does she summon me to her?"
"We are here on a matter of business," they say. His clerk's quills are twitching industriously, but they are alert to every word. They are not unused to visitors of some grandeur, but the organs of aristocracy, let alone equerries of the crown, are something new in this quiet office. He notes with some disconcertion that Oliver Hay is scribbling without removing his eyes from the company.
"We can speak in my own office,"
he says, and they troop past him one by one. Within, he has not an idea of what to do. The mermaid watches from the sideboard.
"Be seated,"
he hazards.
"Oh, we shall not trouble you long,"
says their leader, the most clean-shaven man Mr. Hancock ever saw. There is hardly a shadow upon his face. He is smooth as a youth, although he must be 40.
"We wish to speak to you about your mermaid, which was recently removed from the house of one Mrs. Chapel."
Mr. Hancock nods towards it. The men turn too, and he notes a flicker of discomposure in their demeanour, swiftly suppressed.
"Well, please,"
he says.
"Speak."
"Do you intend to sell it?"
In matters of commerce, he is rarely unprepared for such questions, and although the business with the mermaid first undid his senses entirely, he has passed into a new and absurd sharpness. An understanding that the point at which he judges his demands to be unreasonable is the point he must push beyond.
"Well, that depends," he says.
The men are impassive.
You must appreciate that it brings me revenue. I had expected it to turn a profit for some time longer.
We have money.
Who has sent you?
He asks, although he may judge it well enough from their jewelled badges. In the past, he has arranged for such a coronet to be etched onto 100 mother-of-pearl gaming chips.
An interested party. And it will go into a private collection? Some Wunderkammer? It's my belief this creature will be of scientific use.
It will not go anywhere that scientific men cannot find it. He might laugh aloud. Its little grasping hands have brought uneasiness into his small bubble. He realizes he never wants it back in his sight again.
Well, you've heard my reservations, he says. Make me an offer.
The leader takes a sheet of paper from the desk.
May I?
He dips Mr. Hancock's own pen in the inkwell and writes with lovely fluid movements under the eyes of the dead men hanging on the walls. Mr. Hancock glances up at their painted faces as if they were co-conspirators.
The strangest sale I ever did make, he confides, as if any of you would have believed it.
The visitor hands him the piece of paper, and Mr. Hancock regards the figure in a second that feels as if all the air has been sucked from the room. So still it becomes, and so sluggishly his heart squeezes. The sum is £2,000. This is above what his mermaid cost him. He looks at the number again.
Please, says the equerry. We are open to your counter-offer. Go on.
Dare he double their proposed sum? Quadruple it, even? 8,000 would purchase a ship the Calliope's equal, would finance a new voyage entirely, if he chose. Suki's dowry would be safely set by, his modest empire expanded by another house or two. He will sit in his office, and Tizo Jones will sail his ships, and it will be as if the mermaid never crossed his threshold at all.
Ah, what to do? 6,000? 8,000? 10,000?
He thinks of himself in his counting house the evening before the mermaid arrived, alone and silent, surrounded by such unbearable lack. He walks to his desk and sits down. He takes up his pen, warm from the visitor's hand, and he adds another zero. Thus amended, he pushes the sheet of paper back across the desk, so trepidatious it renders him almost blind. The visitor glances at the new sum, and then says,
"Very well."
Mr. Hancock must steel his jaw to prevent it from flapping open. He had not thought it would be done so easily. He has sold Captain Jones's whim for £20,000, enough to pay off a nobleman's debt, enough to hire a cook to run his kitchen for a century, enough to be another sort of Jonah Hancock than he has been hitherto.
"Your master," he says to the leader of the strangers, "whoever he may be."
"Yes?"
Has he seen this specimen?"
The company, to a man, turns once again to contemplate the beast.
"He has heard excellent things about it," says the equerry. "And so what does it matter?"
"Its appearance is unbeautiful. It is not what people expect of a mermaid."
The visitor is impatient.
"But it is a mermaid. He desired one, and now he has one."
"It is, if I may say, monstrous."
"But it is real."
The visitor straightens the collar of his coat and looks to his men.
"It don't matter what it looks like. It is desired by everyone, and yet it belongs only to him. May we now be away, Mr. Hancock, or did you have other questions?"
"Please, I am more than satisfied."
He notes that the men's eyes linger on the mermaid, and steps before it.
"You'll not take it away today. I shall wait for your payment."
"Of course, of course.
Let me see you out."
He ushers them through the office, where all his men sit up, goggling. In the yard, the stationer's children and their black dog are playing some sort of chasing game and pelt across the flagstones, shrieking, while their pet gambols in pursuit. The visitors are obliged to stride stiffly amongst them, executing little nervous sidesteps when one child or other runs too close to them. Eventually, one of the smaller boys wallops into the leader of the visitors' legs, which throws him sprawling to the ground, clutching his knee. It is at this point that Mr. Hancock closes the door on his benefactors. When it is fast, he leans against it and tries to quiet his breathing so as not to arouse the curiosity of the clerks so nearby. He cannot decide what to think. He holds his hands up before him, and they shake. Chapter 3. Little boy's fingers patter against the window of Mr. Hancock's counting house. He hears the chime of their sticks dragged along the grills in the pavement, and the high, earnest wondering of their talk. If he turned from his desk, he would see their figures slithering in the hall of the glass, swimming and dispersing in its waves. He would see the light of their sunny hair and the stockings wrinkling down their legs as they break into a run, and thus vanish from each pane's vortex. It is a Sunday, a day of exodus, and the families of Deptford are setting out upon their rare pleasures with redoubled determination, it being an unseasonably fine day, perhaps the last they see this year. The women don their gay dresses and fresh-trimmed bonnets, and the men hoist their babies onto their shoulders, and they walk out with children and dogs running about their feet, all equipped with bats and balls and nets and fans, their bread bound in clean cloth, their pennies carefully counted. Stout matrons take their husbands' arms with girlish pleasure, and suitors attend bashfully to their sweethearts, and bands of lads from the yards unbutton their shirts and uncork their first ale of the morning. Out they stride, one and all, bound by river and road for the pleasure gardens at Vauxhall, or the tumbled green hill of Greenwich, or the breeze of Blackheath, where the sky dances with many-coloured kites. They fill the street with the tramp of their feet, and their shouts and laughter waft across the twinkling river water, no matter that it stinks. In the little rowing boats, the women shriek and clutch at their bonnets. The boys spring from stern to pitching prow without anxiety. Mr. Hancock remains at his desk. He is rich now, in the manner of a man long apprenticed in handling other people's money. His wealth drives him to no feverish excess, besides the ordering in, as the weather grows colder, of spiced currant buns and new woollen underwear. He has laid money aside for Suki's dowry and her boy cousin's apprenticeships, but for the most part his ambitions remain unaltered in their substance, merely greater in their scale. He will still build houses, oh, most certainly, but he will build not one terrace, but two, and they will not be here. What man builds in Deptford, after all, who has the means to build in London? And so there is much to be done, and so he remains at his desk. Furthermore, who would he walk out with? In his boyhood he scampered ahead of his sisters amongst those tramping feet with the admonishments of Hester harsh in his ears, but their father rarely came with them, and their mother was dead beyond remembrance. The girls, Grace and Dorry, Rachel and Susan, sometimes ran too, matching their steps to his. They ran altogether like pups in a pack, so hard that their lungs ached with the joy of it. But Hester was right to call them back to her.
"Stay with me,"
she hissed, a skinny girl, as tidy then as she is now.
"Walk nicely. They will say we have no order." "They run,"
he said, spreading his hand at the children vanishing down the lane, the dust clouding behind them.
They have mothers!
And he and Philip, whose skin was tight as a bladder by the time he washed up in the creek all blue and fish-nibbled, and Rachel, who was spirited off to Bristol, no more to see her family, and Grace, who, delivering her first child, bled and bled and bled away, and Dorry and Susan and even Hester grew quiet and took one another's hands. Still they capered, but they doubted themselves and could not skip and leap as carelessly as the other children. Suki has gone for the day. At morning prayers, her favourite spotted kerchief was already knotted about her shoulders, and as he intoned, her feet jigged on the floorboards to run and meet her own sisters at the turnpike. She has been skittish of late, like the cat when she is out of temper, eyeing him suspiciously and saying nothing. This, he knows, is since the sale of the mermaid.
"Oh!"
she had said when he told her.
"Is that all? I thought you would be pleased."
She shrugged and brought her thumbnail to her mouth.
"It is a lot of money,"
he explained to her as she made for the door. Turning, she said in a most accusatory manner,
"I helped you."
"Aye, you did. You're a fine little helper. And now I have done my part too."
But she is out of the door.
"It was mine to sell,"
he called after her. He hopes her day out might restore her cheer. From somewhere in the house, Mr. Hancock hears a strange twittering. He scratches on with his letter, but there is the sound again. A gurgle, fast suppressed. He puts down his pen, venturing from his counting-house and into the hall. The gurgling becomes a giggling, and is joined by others to make a little chorus. The kitchen is dark and cold, made darker yet by the brightness of the open yard door, where Bridget leans against her broom, her back to the room. Her cot is still tumbled in the corner, its blankets thrown back to reveal the dent in the tick where she slept. There are breadcrumbs on the table and a splash of milk, and dishes unwashed. He crosses the room until he is only a few feet away from the yard door, and still Bridget does not notice, so deep is she in mirthful conversation with a knot of young girls who have gathered outside. They have let their good shawls drop from their elbows, guiltily enjoying the sunshine upon their forearms, and they have blacked their brows most startling. While maids, they certainly are, they are also a diminutive masquerade of the town's ladies, each being dressed faithfully but imperfectly in her mistress's cast-off clothes. He recognizes the blue tabby gown, favoured by the doctor's late wife, the black and red trim of the mantua Mrs. Lawlor had been so proud of until she caught its cuff on a candle, the sprigged skirt worn and discarded by all four of the master shipwright's daughters. Poor Bridget, he thinks, to find herself so poorly clothed. It is a wonder she's not run away.
"What's afoot?"
he asks, and the giggling stops. Bridget hardly turns at his approach, but the little mummers outside crane over her shoulder at him.
"Good morning, sir,"
bob the girls, 1, 2, 3.
"And a fine morning it is,"
says the bravest of them.
"Aye," he says, "and what brings you here?"
"Come to say good day, aren't we?"
says Mrs. Lawlor's girl, flirting her patched mantua.
"We're off to Greenwich."
Bridget sighs heavily.
"Back by 6, sir,"
says the girl in the blue tabby, which scrunches along her flanks with its imperfect adjustments.
"All of them going,"
says Bridget.
"Their masters are out, and they are at their liberty."
The girls nod eagerly, and she turns her eyes balefully upon him.
"Well," he says, "but I am still here, and Bridget was off all Thursday afternoon and evening, were you not?"
"My mother had need of me,"
she protests.
I was not at my leisure.
You've had your freedom for the week. 'Tis not my lookout what you used it for.
The girls fall quiet.
But may I not?
Bridget gestures to the girls, the dresses, the sunlight, as if drawing his notice to what he might otherwise have overlooked. He steps back from the door to let the girls see inside.
Crumbs, he says, on the table.
He tries to be jovial, but it takes an effort to keep the tremble from his voice. This is not his sphere. His dominion over Bridget ought to be at great remove, as God's dominion over his subjects, with many intercessors before the one is necessitated to confront the other. And yet in this house there is not one intercessor. And so he goes on.
And her bed not touched since she left it. My dear young ladies, I trust none amongst you left your duties undone before you took your liberty.
The maids are mute. Bridget, too, an angry pink spot burning on each of her cheeks.
A fool, he thinks as his heart pounds, to be afraid of a mere girl.
But he cannot afford mutiny. And Suki's disappointment if Bridget were to quit his service, and the trouble of finding a new maid, for he has not the privilege of the circle of Deptford ladies who advise one another which girls are reliable and how to train those that are not, even to think of it is to sense defeat.
"Will you be sure and do your work the moment you're back?"
he asks Bridget.
"And leave the kitchen as clean as Mrs. Lippard would expect to discover it, were she to arrive tomorrow?"
The girls ripple their pleasure, but Bridget merely nods, already tugging her apron loose.
"Of course,"
she says, and leans her broom against the wall. She retrieves from beneath the carver chair Suki's sprigged jacket, all screwed into a ball, and shoves an arm into its sleeve.
"Well?"
he says, as she knots its tapes across her stays.
"Mm?"
"You've no thank you for my kindness?"
She looks at him then, briefly and quizzingly.
"Thank you,"
she says.
Thank you, much obliged."
Fading away as she steps out of the door and closes it behind her, it becomes dark in the kitchen, without a shriek of laughter. He takes himself back to his desk and is much displeased. Chapter 4 Mr. Rockingham has observed, of course, that the austere Mrs. Frost seems to have taken a dislike to him. He needed no more evidence than the tone in her voice when, the third consecutive night he spent in Angelica's bed, she said,
"Oh, are you still here?"
And now, a week later, he curls once more next to his lady, while her erstwhile companion taps in vain at the door. They are playing spillikins on a lacquer tray they have brought into the bed for that purpose, for as a pair their tastes lean towards the infantile and the trifling. He is resting his palm on the spot where Angelica's hip becomes her thigh, and she is making a great flirtatious show of extracting a stick from the heap on the tray, a fatuous endeavour since they slide in all directions every time she giggles, when Mrs. Frost taps again.
"What is it?"
calls Angelica.
"I need to speak to you."
Angelica groans.
"Tell her to go away,"
whispers George, inveigling a finger beneath her chemise.
"In a moment," says Angelica. "Perhaps she has something to say for herself."
She rolls over and calls out,
"What do you want?"
"Come out here. I wish to speak with you."
"Whatever you have to say, it may be said in front of Georgie."
The door opens a crack, and a small slice of Mrs. Frost's face appears at it. Angelica and her lover loll like sun-drunk seals on the shore, his hand half within her chemise. Mrs. Frost fixes her eye to the wall somewhere to the left of the bed, and says,
"Mrs. Chapel has sent a chair for you. You're wanted at King's Place."
Angelica pauses.
"Well, that's interesting."
She's not seen Mrs. Chapel since their disagreement over the removal of the mermaid, and her pride does not permit her to recognize the conciliatory nature of the sedan.
"I shan't go,"
she says briefly. She taps her index finger upon George's lower lip.
"She don't deserve me."
"Are you certain you..."
"Go away!"
The door closes abruptly. Without, Mrs. Frost waits a moment.
"The chair is here," she says.
"For pity's sake!"
Angelica rises and draws her wrap about her.
"Take your turn,"
she says to Rockingham, nudging the tray of sticks towards him.
"I trust you to play fairly."
She pads in her bare feet out into the corridor where Mrs. Frost is waiting.
"What are you thinking?"
she hisses.
"I'm reminding you of your duties,"
says Mrs. Frost primly. Angelica seizes her elbow and fairly shoves her into the living room.
"You have no right,"
she whispers furiously.
"I've told you before, if Georgie is here, you send callers away. No questions."
"Mrs. Chapel may send for you as she pleases."
"Even after she was so fearful rude to me?"
"I should think not." "Do not disoblige her. She wishes to keep you in the fold, and you ought to be grateful for it. To be seen at her house, to hold your assignations there, 'tis a privilege."
"One I do not need,"
says Angelica.
"Mr. Rockingham is the sole recipient of my attention. Send the chair away. Tell old Mother Chapel I'll not pander to her any longer."
"And how are we to eat?"
demands Mrs. Frost.
"Oh, histrionics! How are we to eat? When have we ever gone hungry?"
"We may yet."
"No, we may not. George takes care of us. And Eliza, I know what you're about. You pretend your concern is with the money, and oh, how sensible and prudent you are. But that is not the case, is it? It is because he claims a greater part of me than you do."
"Nothing of the sort."
"You are jealous."
"I'm trying to protect you."
"You protect me? I am the protector. I give you good clothes and a place to sleep in return for really very few demands on your time, and yet all you do is defy me. I think you forget sometimes where you would be without me."
"You're turning away good connections," entreats Mrs. Frost.
"On the shelf,"
Angelica taunts her.
"That is where you would be. On the shelf, like a pawned short gown."
Mrs. Frost will not be provoked.
"You're isolating yourself. You must stay in the favour of the world. And when you shut yourself away, you..."
Angelica digs her nails into her palms. Her face is hot and her ears ring.
"What would you have me be?"
she demands.
"First, I am putting myself about like a common drab in your opinion, and I must find myself a respectable keeper. Now I am true to one gentleman, and you say I ought to be less discriminating. Which is it?"
Mrs. Frost does not betray much anger, but her face is notably without colour.
"How many nights this week have you gone out?"
"I was out until dawn on Wednesday."
"With Mr. Rockingham? You are never without him. You do not respond to invitations. You do not repay Mrs. Chapel's kindness. You are not at home to men who might really help you, who would further you in the world."
"I don't want furthering. I want to be happy."
"You've chose the wrong man. This happiness is not of a sort worth having."
"Oh, get you gone, Eliza Frost. Get you gone. As if you would know anything at all about it."
She flounces back to her chamber, her hair bouncing down her back, wiping her face on the sleeve of her chemise. Within, Rockingham sits up in the bed.
"What's wrong, dear heart?"
he asks, and she sets about weeping again, noisily and messily.
"Oh, come here, you poor creature."
And he opens his arms up to her. She gets onto the bed on her knees and wilts against him.
"She wants me to give you up,"
she sobs.
Is that what she said?
Almost, in so many words.
And what did you tell her? She sits back, wiping her eyes.
Of course, I said no, of course. What pleasure would there be in this world for me without you?
He wipes her tears with his thumb, which is no match for them.
Here, he says, and mops her face with a bedsheet. Why don't she want me with you?
Oh, she is a sad, ignorant husk of a woman.
She sniffs hard.
And also, she's afraid about money.
He frowns. With reason?
She thinks, well, 'tis a small thing, really. She thinks that if you were not here, I would see more men, and we would be better off.
Do you see other men?
His face shows true surprise. Looking all askance at him, she tries to laugh it away.
I hardly have the time. You would know, would you not, if I were entertaining others?
But you would see them.
He withdraws his hand from hers as if it were a glowing ember.
What else would I do? She thinks. How else does he imagine I pay my way?
Aloud, she says only,
No, no, no!
With nothing to cling to, she knots the tear-damp bedsheets about her fingers.
Not if I did not need the money.
I had not.
He gazes at her face in stupefaction. I did not think.
'Tis always the way, she thinks. Treat them as if they are the centre of the world, and they do not hesitate to believe it. A charmed life these men lead, if they have never needed to look beneath the surface of things.
Knowing his next emotion will be anger, she grasps about for something to say.
It can't be helped, she tries. You must understand my circumstances. Of course I would not gain a moment's pleasure from other men's society. Of course it would wound me horribly. And all the while my heart would break at my betrayal of you.
This is untrue. Angelica has no particular feelings about spending an evening of mutual flattery with a stranger. On the whole, she finds it enjoyable. Besides, she knows that to privilege desire in one particular man's bosom is not to extinguish it from all others. There is no mutual exclusivity in attraction, and therefore it is no crime to encourage it wherever it appears. But she has come upon few men who appreciate this argument.
And what would you do with them? He demands. Would you lie with them? As you do with me?
No!
Perhaps. She folds her arms across her naked bosom and says coldly,
I am no whore, sir. No mercenary. Pray do not think me so base.
What then? What do you do with them that they pay you for so handsomely?
She shrugs.
They have my company, that is all. I play a little music, I make conversation. They may escort me to plays and parties if they desire it, and if I am amenable to being seen about with them.
He had thought she smiled upon nobody the way she did him.
You might as well open your legs to them.
She begins to weep again, having over the course of her career developed a great knack for pathos.
Oh, how can you say it? Georgie, how can you? I allow them to be near me. That is all, a privilege you enjoy gratis.
Raising her swimming eyes to him, she sees he is gazing steadfast out of the window.
And if they bring me presents, she continues tremulously, it is because they know with what great difficulty a woman survives in this city, and not with the expectation of any favour. That I only bestow upon the one man I truly love.
But her words are in vain. He rises from the bed, and she has a glimpse of his glorious buttocks before he pulls his shirt on.
Smelly old men,
she says, ascending again into a lament,
who fart in their sleep and talk about their years in the cavalry. Do you think I enjoy a moment of it?
So do not do it. He buttons his breeches.
I have no other way of keeping myself together.
She wipes her eyes on her wrist and adds in a scandalized whisper.
Some of them have hair that grows from the tips of their noses.
What decent woman finds she must keep herself together at all? He demands. The very fact that you must support yourself is a judgment on you. I'm going.
But where?
She rises now in true fear.
Wait for me.
She gathers up her clothes.
Wait! I shall come with you.
Do not follow me. I can't bear to be seen with you. Chapter 5. In the evening, the families returning in tired straggles, the lovers still unaccounted for in the hedgerows, Jem Thorpe arrives at Mr. Hancock's door. He puts his palm flat upon its frame, his other fist propped loosely upon his hip. He looks as he is, a man at the end of a day of leisure, still and smiling, as if the sunshine his skin took up now sits warmly within him.
I came, he says. Like you asked of me. I'm at liberty to build your houses, and my boy's eager to start.
He reaches up and pats the belly of one of the twin cherubs flanking the lintel, put there by his grandfather, and fluttering still. Oh, says Mr. Hancock, who, in the absence of the girls from the house, has been compelled to get his dinner from the pie shop, and now guiltily shakes crumbs from his cuffs.
There will be no need.
Mr. Thorpe is as a man still awaiting an answer. He stands a moment longer, blinks, and says,
"Why's that, then?"
Mr. Hancock shrugs. Above him the cherubs are frozen in their joy, flourishing scrolled paper and compasses, ready to draft edifices as yet unthought of.
"If you mean no longer to put up any houses," says Mr. Thorpe, "I would strongly counsel you to change your mind."
He puffs with enthusiasm.
"Now is the time, sir. So many are in want of a genteel sort of living, and you are in a fine position to supply it."
"Certainly I am," says Mr. Hancock. "But I have bought a very handsome parcel of land in Marylebone, where I mean to do so." Mr. Thorpe takes his hand from the cherub and places it upon his wigged pate.
"A great distance from here," he says.
"Quite so," says the merchant. "In London, or near as makes no difference. The countryside there is wide and pretty, and so close to the fashionable squares. Every gentleman wants a country home, and how right you are, sir. Now is the time. Now is the time." Jem Thorpe clings to his notion like a drowning man.
"That is a great distance for my team to travel," he says. "I suppose you..."
But the supposing, however groped for, does not come to him.
"You mean to take your business elsewhere?"
he concludes flatly.
"You mean not to hire my men?"
"It would, I fear, hardly be practical."
Mr. Hancock is anxious for his pigeon pie cooling on his desk, a skin puckering upon its gravy.
"A shame, but what is there to be done? Now, you must allow me..." "There is plenty to be done," says Jem Thorpe. "Were you not born here?" "Yes, you were. I know you, I know your family. And your father would never have treated my father in the manner you now treat me."
Mention of his father pricks at Mr. Hancock. He shuffles, defenceless, as the shipwright goes on.
"If each man born here were to do as you are doing, there would be no town left at all. Make your fortune in London, sir. Nobody grudges you that. But do not spend it there, too."
"I must look to my own interests."
"Your interests are our interests."
Mr. Thorpe's eyes have a great deal of white to them.
"Or ought to be. Sir, why build there when you can build here?"
He shakes his head.
"Why keep an ass when you have the means for racehorses?" That is where the opportunity is, he says.
You have the money.
Jem jabs his finger. Therefore you make the opportunity. He looks about himself.
I declare, you're as bad as the Admiralty. They grudge us the work we are due, and now so do you.
The pain these words causes Mr. Hancock is startling.
I have bought land here, he protests. Good growing land at Ladywell. I shall cultivate fruit and vegetables. Those want jobs.
Fruit picking, spits Thorpe. Children's work, old women's work, not for my men. Unrivaled, sir, unrivaled in their capabilities. No, if we cannot build ships, we ought at least to build houses.
My hiring you would be no more than an act of charity, says Mr. Hancock.
An act of unity!
Mr. Thorpe would almost place his foot at the threshold. Instead, he doffs hat and wig and all and clasps them to his chest. His head is shiny back to its crown and thence fuzzed with greying curls.
Come, sir, says he. We cannot go on without regular employment.
I am sorry, says Mr. Hancock.
They stand in dismay, neither one knowing what else to say. Jem Thorpe knows certainly what he would say, for once or twice he draws breath and shifts upon his feet as if he were about to burst again into speech. But as for what he should say, he is at a loss, and so remains silent. From far down the street and beyond the lane there comes a voice, such a scrap of a call as might be made by a bird, and at such distance as to make it of no significance. Jem Thorpe, however, marks it, and tips his head. It comes again a little nearer.
Daddy!
Ah, he says. My children. And they are at the end of Union Street, a girl in a white apron and a boy in white stockings, bending at the waist in their enthusiasm to shout his name.
Come home!
They call, cupping their hands about their mouths.
Mama says, where be you?
My children, he repeats. You do not think of them. I suppose you have no occasion to. I'm coming!
He holds a hand up to them. To Mr. Hancock, he says,
it is clear to me that you share none of our concerns. None. That is to your discredit, not to ours.
Mr. Hancock is torn quite in two. He has sought to make the best profit he can from the surprise of his mermaid, to rescue his reputation from mockery, and to raise himself some little way up in the world. He is inquisitive, in fact, as to what might come next, and refreshed by the newness of his situation. To build in a place where his forebears have not built before, and for people with whom he shares no bond of blood or society, is an appealing prospect. Why should he not build in Marylebone, if he wishes? And yet the cost of it is more than he can stomach.
Jem,
he says as Mr. Thorpe walks away.
Jem, attend a moment.
He descends from his step and pursues the shipwright, who wavers.
I do have work for you. I lost my ship.
He shuffles in the dirt. He had not yet thought what to do about the Calliope's replacement. This decision comes almost viscerally, as if he had made it in peril of his life.
I shall need a new one.
Mr. Thorpe is quiet for a moment. He narrows his eyes as if Mr. Hancock were a troubling calculation.
Truly, says Mr. Hancock, you and any men you like. I'll leave that to your own judgment. I won't meddle in your methods for even one second. And you'll pay us what we are worth. Aye, and the sweepings, the chips, all the wood that's over, that is yours too. As it should be. As it should be.
The children of Jem Thorpe caper up now and tuck themselves one under each of his arms. Their eyes are very bright with their exertion, and their shoulders heave as they snatch at their breath. Mr. Thorpe cups his palm about the back of his son's head.
Very well, he says. Time I return to my home.
And you are satisfied? Asks Mr. Hancock. The children watch dumbly.
Aye,
says Jem Thorpe. And although he does not smile, his brow uncreases itself and he stands a little taller.
That is the work I want.
Good.
Oh, but Jem, I want one more thing.
What's that?
I've a new venture in mind. I need a ship right away. Something modest and seaworthy, for business in the North Sea only. Not much beyond, I would not have thought. Do you know of anything likely?
Mr. Thorpe squints.
The North Sea? That is not your usual area. We must always be prepared for change. That is how we survive. Aye. Well, I reckon I know a likely bet. The Unicorn, on the blocks at Mitchell's Yard, although he has no buyer for it yet. You might take a look.
Much obliged. Jem Thorpe walks away with his children swinging at his arms, filling up his long strides with their leaps and skips. Mr. Hancock shades his eyes against the reddening horizon to see them go, and meanwhile hears, from this place and that, in streets unseen, the rising calls of women as they go to their thresholds and call home the ones they love. The bells of St. Paul's and St. Nicholas's begin to chime in conversation with one another, and from the back lane rises the percussion of children's running feet. Mr. Hancock returns to his own doorstep, where no wife stands with her arms outstretched to him, and no children buzz with their observations of the day. The cat, at least, emerges from some shadow or other, and remarks upon his arrival with an impertinent chirp. He bends to chaff her ears, but she'll none of it, and swipes at his hand, and canters crook-backed across the floorboards with her tail puffed up. "Please yourself," he murmurs, and pacing alone to his cold pie, is perplexingly put in mind of Angelica Neal, as if she had just sighed past him in the darkness of the hall. He thinks, how much longer can I tie myself to this town? Heaven help me, I'll not tolerate such solitude much longer. He thinks what he has long known. There is not a single woman in Deptford who will please me.
Chapter 6 Angelica is sick with nerves. She has never known a thing like it. For 2 days she walks about her rooms and weeps intermittently. Grief crouches like a demon on her chest by night. By day it hangs about her shoulders, and every little thing sets her off crying again. The first evening she cannot control the panic in her breast. She writes to him and pays for its delivery. But although she stays by the window all night and through into the next morning, there is no reply. Her food is like ashes in her mouth. She cannot look at Mrs. Frost, who is unable to entirely conceal her satisfaction at Mr. Rockingham's departure.
"Perhaps you should try going out," says Mrs. Frost, as coaxingly as she is able. "The theatre. You like that? Shall I write to some of your acquaintances? I think one of them will have a box for you."
"No. No, no theatre. I must wait here in case he sends word."
"And then the pleasure gardens are busy, they say, now that Parliament is back in session."
Tears escape Angelica's closed eyes and roll down her cheeks.
"I cannot," she says. "I cannot be seen in such a way. I want nothing of any of this."
"Now, you must try."
"Why? What is the use in it? Oh, it's all very well for you to say. This is a triumph for you, is it not? You have not had your heart broken."
"Angelica, you've not known him even 2 weeks."
"Juliet knew Romeo 3 days."
"And if you'd paid as much attention to the play as you do the audience, you would know not an ounce of good came of it. You're being a fool."
You are made of stone.
I will summon Mrs. Fortescue, says Mrs. Frost. She will have some sense.
No,
cries Angelica in a panic.
Not Belle, I beg you. Do not let Belle know of this misfortune. And besides,
she spits,
she's married now. Her fine Hanover Square wedding won at such expense. She'll want none of me now she's elevated.
Well, perhaps then...
Leave me be. I want nothing. I want only to wait for him.
Angelica flounces into her bedroom. She may be forgiven if such stirrings of amorous passion came as a shock to her. Being spurned by the object of her most ardent affection is quite beyond Angelica Neal's apprehension. Love grapples judgment and experience from the hands of even the wisest of souls. What hope is there for anybody else? On the morning of the third day, he returns. She is locked in her bedroom, her eyes raw with blue shadows beneath. Her chemise reeks and is stained, for she has not thought to change it in days, and until this moment had barely noticed. She marks this fact with some interest. Her anguish is most certainly genuine, then. Even her hair is in disarray. When all of a sudden she hears his voice softly without, she thinks her heart must crash out of her body. She thinks the blood pounds so hard in her veins it must rupture them one by one. She can barely stand for shaking, but she stumbles to the door and hears Mrs. Frost's voice.
Greatly distressed. No time. Let her be.
Angelica throws open her door. In the living room, Mr. Rockingham looks as sorry as she, his hat in his hands and his face all drawn and tired.
Good day, sir,
she says, and it is an agony to look upon him. She does not know if he is hers. She thinks she will not bear it if he has only come to take himself away again. He looks at her and looks and parts his lips helplessly. His poor, bruised eyes are fixed upon her face, and he reaches out his hands.
I've barely slept while we were parted, he croaks. At the gaming table all night, I suppose, says Mrs. Frost.
Go away, Eliza,
whispers Angelica.
You can tell it by the stink of him, says her friend. He's been carousing, not pining. Open your eyes, madam.
Angelica is gazing steadily at her lieutenant. She swallows hard.
I said, go away.
They lie on their naked bellies side by side, and Mr. Rockingham strokes his hand down Angelica's back. He fits his fingers into the valley of her spine. On either side her flesh swells warm and soft to her hips, her waist, her ribs. Her eyes are closed. There is a little gloss of sweat in the crook of her elbow where she pillows her face. Her curls are bound safely, but the pleats of her cap are crushed. The corner of her mouth twitches upward.
Why do you keep that woman with you? Asks Georgie, when you and she are so at odds.
She sighs and her eyelids flutter.
We are more often in accord, she whispers. She is my most beloved friend.
She is not the first woman to confuse beloved with necessary.
You are too loyal.
No, no,
she turns to him, pulling her knees up to her chest and blinking sweetly.
We've known one another a long time, since I first arrived in London.
She will not tell him of the days they were maids together in a magistrate's house, for she likes to screw her history tight inside her bosom. The past is the past, and beyond helping, it strikes her as unseemly, untidy, unnecessary to air it. Nor, therefore, will she tell him that it was Mrs. Frost who first encouraged her into the Temple of Venus, and thence King's Place. When she remembers their being girls, racked with laughter at one another's hilarity, or crushed into a narrow bed as dawn broke, whispering their secrets to one another, she feels such warmth. And so she only says, "She was kind to me when there was no other soul to remember me."
Hmm.
Perhaps she's sadder now than she once was. She cannot have George think she chooses her friends carelessly. And so her good qualities are not as evident to you as they are to me. You do not know the hardships an abandoned wife must endure.
"Abandoned," says Rockingham. "Stuff and nonsense. She can hardly want for her husband. You treat her so well."
"If I could do more, I would," says Angelica with pride. "She might have gone her own way, might she not, when my protector died and I was penniless? And she did not. She found me this place, and she's got me well set." She closes her eyes again and hooks her fingers through his. "She's helped me in all kinds of ways. You cannot imagine."
Still he persists. "But she does not help you now."
He is stung more by her tender history with Mrs. Frost than by her mention of her old lover. "Maybe not."
"And besides," he presses his body to hers, dragging the sheet over their heads, "you have me now. I'm here to help you. I am your friend. And I mean to be your keeper, too."
These words fizz in her blood. "Really?"
"Truly." He takes her face in his hands. "You need struggle no longer. You need not see other men. I shall pay for you."
"Oh."
"Anything. Anything you need. Say the word." He seizes her wrists, and she feels him growing hard again. She is overwhelmed with him. Her fingertips brush his hair. His breath is on her cheek. Their noses touch, their teeth, their eyelashes.
"I shall never have you want for so much as a pen," he says.
"You're so kind. My love. My love." And such heat and an aching in her heart, she does not know what to do with, as if she were bewitched.
"And you will be mine,"
he whispers, hooking one thigh between hers, so that they fall open. She draws him into her arms.
"All and entirely my own. Oh, my dear one."
But here is Mrs. Frost tapping at the door.
"Angelica," she insists. "Angelica, come out. You're wanted here."
Rockingham lets out a groan and flops onto his back.
"That woman!"
"Perhaps you are right," says Angelica. "She is overbearing in the extreme." She sits up. "Shall I go to her then?"
"No, no," he caresses. "Stay here with me."
"I think I must, or she will never be easy." Angelica rises naked from the bed and opens the door in her perfect undress. "What now, Spindleshanks?" she demands. She has a delightful, plump body, classical in its proportions, although her legs are a little too short. And while some years have passed since she caught the painterly eye of Mr. Romney in King's Place, she remains testament to his good taste. Mrs. Frost will not look at her. She fixes her gaze upon the door handle.
"There is a man here to see you."
Angelica leans against the door frame, her arm behind her head. Her breasts rise pacifically. "There is a man already here to see me," she says. "I know not how else to convey to you that I am indisposed."
"He has been here before, again and again. You may know him. He says he is the Mermaid Man."
She laughs.
"The Mermaid Man? Georgie, mark this. That gentleman who brought us together, the man who discovered the horrid little sea sprite, is waiting to see me. Well, he could not tolerate me before, so I wonder what has changed."
She claps her hand to her mouth.
"Oh, does he believe he can afford me now?"
What did I hear? That the thing is sold? It means to trade one curiosity in for another? Eliza, what fun! Did you bring him inside?
No. He's still on the street.
That's as well. But what am I to tell him?